I remember sitting 2 years ago at Thanksgiving and watching a performance by the Philadelphia Symphony under Eugene Ormandy. It was his 80th birthday. And Ormandy had been called back in to direct the orchestra for a Thanksgiving special. And prior to the orchestra performance, there was an interview with Ormandy, who had been for many, many, many years the director of the Philadelphia Symphony. And he was sharing an experience that he had had with Sergei Rachmaninoff, composer. He had known Rachmaninoff. And how they were getting ready to play Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, and making their debut in the United States with the Second Symphony. And Rachmaninoff had presented the musical score to him. And Ormandy had made some suggestions of cuts that he thought should be made in the musical score. Only a Eugene Ormandy could have said to a Sergei Rachmaninoff, "I don't think you should have this in your piece." And he had made 8 suggestions of music that should be cut from the original score, and Rachmaninoff had agreed to 7 of those cuts before the Philadelphia Orchestra played it. But the 8th cut, he said that he could not agree to that 8th cut, because he said if you take that out, then the entire symphony loses its meaning. And so Ormandy played it as Rachmaninoff finally agreed in the final play. I'm familiar with that process, because I know in the books that I have written and the magazine articles that I have written, that I am constantly working with editors who are cutting basically for the sake of space, magazine articles in particular with this. And they will, oftentimes the editing process will be in order to fit it onto a page. And I will find myself sometimes saying to a magazine editor, "Yes, you can cut that, and yes, you can cut that, and yes, you can, but you cannot cut that. Because if you cut that, then everything that I have said really makes no sense, because you have read it for the sake of space and I am reading it for the sake of theme and content and intent, and so you must not cut that." I think about that sometimes. I was thinking about this whole little story about Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Symphony as I was reading through a very familiar little biblical story found in the 19th chapter of the book of Luke, which is a story in the life of Jesus, of when Jesus had been in Jericho being a prospering town, an oasis town at the northern end of the Dead Sea. It was a trade town, because it was the place to where those who came across from the other side of Jordan, it was their first stop as they entered into the nation of Israel. It was a very popular place for the Roman legions who were there, because it was an oasis town, and there's an abundance of life in Jericho, because it is fed by the Jordan River and by the water that flows down off the mountains, and so it's a prospering place with fruit and flowers and many other things. And King Herod had his summer palace just above Jericho. The remains of the Herodian palace still remain. And Jesus was in Jericho and had an experience with a bureaucrat, with a government official. Let me read the passage to you. Jesus entered Jericho. This is Luke 19. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through, and a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. The two things always went together, of being chief tax collector and the fact that he was wealthy. Now, a brief word about the tax collecting system, which some of you are familiar with, but the whole concept of the tax collecting system under the Roman Empire was a system of favors. You had to, first of all, you had to buy or blackmail your way into favor with the Roman government, which was the puppet government over the not the puppet government, the ruling government over the nation of Israel. And then underneath that was a puppet government that was carried on by the king system, the monarch system in Israel. But the Romans were in charge. And the Romans collected taxes, but they didn't use their own people to collect taxes. They used Jews to collect taxes from their Jewish counterparts. And that was done by a system of rewards. You would buy the position of tax collector, and in this case of chief tax collector, which would have been tax collector over the whole Jericho district. And so Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector, meaning he had bought his way into this system. And the reason you buy into it, much as a person would buy into a dry cleaning franchise or a drugstore franchise or any other kind of business franchise, was it was a very lucrative thing, because the Roman government allowed the tax collectors to extort money out of the people themselves. And so here was a little dealer of some kind, a small businessman who had a booth out on the street or owned a small piece of property or had some kind of a business enterprise, and he was required to pay taxes to the Roman government. But the tax collector himself had a huge amount of power, in that he could go to that individual and extract from him not just the taxes he owed, but two or three times as much. And he was then able to pocket everything that did not belong to the Romans. And so if the man's taxes were $100 a year, he could go to him and collect $300 a year. And the man really had no recourse, because he knew that the tax collector could very well report back to the Romans that the man had not paid his taxes at all if he only gave him $100. And then he would be thrown into prison or even have his life taken away from him. And so they were totally at the mercy of this corrupt tax collecting system. The chief tax collector not only was able to do that, but he was able to take a rake off from all of the people who worked under him at the same time. So the chief tax collector was always an extremely wealthy man. On the other hand, he was a hated man, because he would have been one of the Jews, not only because he was corrupt, but because he was a quisling. He had turned against his own people for the sake of money, and was willing to have his own people persecuted simply for the sake of money. So his name was Zacchaeus, and he was a chief tax collector, and he was wealthy. And he wanted to see who Jesus was. Now, we don't know anything about this whole concept as to why the desire was in his heart, but I think the same desire was in Zacchaeus' heart. I remember going to a number of the Catherine Kuhlman meetings in California, and it was interesting the people who came to see her in her meetings. There were those who were genuinely attracted who came. And then there was a great host of curiosity people who came because they knew that she was a great entrepreneur. They would say, anybody who can draw 8,000 people by just announcing, didn't even use newspaper ads, that once a month they would go into Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles and pack that, they'd only fill it up, but there would be sometimes 2,000 and 3,000 people on the outside who couldn't even get in. And these business people in Los Angeles driving up and down those streets would see those folks and said, anybody who can do that, I've got to learn from them. She's got some kind of secret. I mean, you know, here's folks who couldn't get anybody at all. And so they were attracted by her and by her personality. The magicians would come to Catherine Kuhlman's meeting because they heard that she was doing these magical tricks from the stage and healing the sick. And so they would show up. And all kinds of weird charlatans. The entertainers would show up because they wanted to find out what it was about this woman who could draw a crowd. The comedians in Los Angeles, the stand-up comedians, the television and radio comedians would show up because they were playing all the little nightclubs around the area and they couldn't get anybody to come and nobody was paying attention to them when they were in there. And so they would come to learn the tricks of this woman. And I have a feeling that Zacchaeus was probably in that kind of mentality, that here was a man, Jesus, and folks were following him, and he didn't have anybody to follow him. He was looking out for himself and trying to learn some of the tricks that Jesus had in being able to do this, plus the fact the word had already gotten around that Jesus didn't have to extract taxes, that he could point people to go down to the Sea of Galilee and find money in the mouth of fishes. And surely a hedonist like Zacchaeus, who was in the money business, would want to find out how that was done. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. And so he ran ahead, climbed a sycamore tree, actually a fig tree, to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Now, if you've ever seen the fig trees in Israel, you could really get a joke out of this thing. Sycamore tree was really not what he was climbing, but it was a fig tree. And the fig trees in Israel are actually huge bushes that will grow up sometimes 15, 20 feet tall. But they have many, many, many branches, just all kinds of stalks. And I keep trying to picture this little guy in that huge bush. I mean, it's not just an ordinary tree where you're sitting on the lower branch of the tree. He's climbed up inside of this bush, swaying back and forth, holding on to one of the trunks of this fig tree, all these leaves all around him so that he can see Jesus when he comes by. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and saw this strange thing of this man up in this fig tree and called him by name, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." And so he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. And all the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." Lloyd Douglas, in his magnificent novel called The Robe, tells the story of Zacchaeus, an interesting story that he has in there. And he rearranges this thing just a little bit, as novelists often do, and maybe is very accurate as far as the facts are concerned. But he tells the story of Zacchaeus coming down out of this fig bush, And Jesus going home with him to his house. He was a wealthy man, and so he had a very palatial home in Jericho, and a number of people following him. There were the Jews who hated Zacchaeus. There were the Pharisees and the scribes who were really upset that Jesus had even gone into this man's house. There were the people who were angry with Zacchaeus, hated him because of who he was. And so these folks all followed them home, plus the crowd that was following Jesus anyway, went. And so Jesus and Zacchaeus go into the house, and they are having lunch together. And as Lloyd Douglas tells the story, he said, in the middle of lunch, Zacchaeus abruptly gets up from the table and goes outside through the little courtyard, out through the gate where all of these people are standing, and makes an announcement to the people and said, "Today I am going to give back all the money that I have stolen. Not only am I going to give it back, but I'm going to return fourfold whatever I have stolen." Now, the law said that if you were a thief, you had to give back double. Zacchaeus is saying, "I'm going to give back four times as much." Speaking to this mob of people, and says, "Not only that, but I'm going to take half of everything else that I have, and I'm going to give it to feed the poor." And then he turns and walks back in and sits down at the table. Jesus is sitting there. has heard all that's going on out there where Zacchaeus is making this public announcement to the people. And Jesus says to him, "What in the world, Zacchaeus, inspired you to do that? We were just sitting here having lunch, and all of a sudden you jump up from the table and rush out and make this huge announcement. What got into you to do that?" And the answer that Zacchaeus gives is classic. For he says, "Master, as I sat here and looked into your eyes, I saw Zacchaeus the way God intended him to be. As I looked into your eyes, I saw Zacchaeus the way God intended him to be." Rachmaninoff said to Eugene Ormandy, "You can cut here, and you can cut here, and you can cut here, and you can, but you cannot cut there. Because if you cut there, the musical composition won't make any sense. The one thing that we cannot take out of this Bible, we can cut here, and we can cut here, and we can cut there, but the one thing that we can't take out, the one thing that we cannot remove from our experience is Jesus Christ. Because in him we find who God intends for us to be. As we look at him, we see ourselves reflected." Someplace in some of his letters, the composer Tchaikovsky said about Mozart, Wolfgang Mozart, whom he had never met, who had composed before his time. And Tchaikovsky said about Mozart, "I owe all of my musical life to Mozart." Essentially what he was saying is, because of what this man wrote, I am who I am. He has inspired me, and because of his musical composition, something has gone off inside of me at the same time. The old concept of ringing the bell, the single bell, and if you ring the single bell, all the other bells begin to vibrate and ring at the same time. And that's what Jesus does. That's what he did to Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, not only sitting at lunch with him, but in the tree, looked down. And suddenly he saw in Jesus the thing that set his bell going. And later on, legend says that Zacchaeus said the same thing of Jesus that Tchaikovsky said of Mozart. "Everything I am is because of him. He set the music going in my life." I don't know where you are tonight with your tree climbing episodes. I don't know where you are with your business experiences. I don't know in what areas there is darkness in your life. I don't know what areas there is deadness. I don't know where you are in your life that the music may have gone out, stopped playing. But I say to you tonight, on the basis of this word that is given to us here, that when you come into an expression of love with Jesus Christ, when you look into his eyes, that you too will hear him say, "Today, salvation has come to this house." Before we leave tonight, I'd like for us to get quiet again. We kind of started the meeting with this. I'd like for us to get quiet and to look into the face of Jesus. And I'd like you to do that with your eyes closed, because if you open your eyes, you'll see a lot of other things. You're not here tonight simply because it's Sunday night. You're not here tonight because some of you brought your children. You're here tonight because there is a beckoning. Zacchaeus really didn't go up into that tree just to find out who Jesus was. He went because there was some kind of tug on his heart. And God is still tugging us toward Him. Each one of us needs to make another step in that direction. And you can cut a lot of things out of your life, but you can't cut Jesus out. You can take this Bible and say, there's a lot of things in there I don't understand, and therefore I'm just not paying any attention to them. But you can't say that about Jesus, the Son of God. And He's still here, and He's still saying, look into my eyes and see your reflection. So if you've got a tough day facing you tomorrow, I've got a tough day facing me tomorrow. A lot of things I'm going to have to do. You're way behind on a lot of things. You're going to have to catch up. There's always the added things that are coming in that you're not going to have time for. Jesus Christ will give you the creativity, the ability to do the supernatural in your job, to speak to those problem areas, those places you're going to have to face some things tomorrow, just to touch you right where you are and to bring you to a place to where the things in your life that are wrong will be straightened out. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make His face to shine upon you. May the Lord lift up His countenance.